I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca, a recent publication that's not only a handsome book, but a thorough overview, is Sculpture in Canada, a History. The distinguished historian Maria Tippett joins me now, and I'll get her to tell us about this illustrated study of sculpture in this country from 13,000 BCE to the Inuit and First Nations practice to that which came over here from Europe and elsewhere. We get a sense of the meaning of carving statues, this art in our history and culture. Dr. Tippett also provides a glimpse of the future as virtual reality and 3D modeling yields technological advancement. There's a great sense in this book of a rich heritage, and we also meet some of the fascinating artists along the way. Dr. Maria Tippett has written over a dozen books on art and cultural history, including Emily Carr, a biography, which was the 1979 recipient of the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. She was first on this program when her 2015 book, Made in British Columbia, Eight Ways of Making Culture, was published. It was a finalist for the Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize. Maria has taught at Simon Fraser University, the University of British Columbia, and Emily Carr University. She was a research senior research fellow at the Churchill College at Cambridge in England. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Planta on the Line program on Pender Island, British Columbia, Maria Tippett. Dr. Tippett, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We tend to think of sculptures as just statues, but, I mean, I was looking at the Ellie Bornstein piece. I mean, they take on different forms, don't they?
Yes. Today, sculpture can be anything. It can be what is called land art, which is a mound of sand that, when the tide comes in, washes away. It can be a black box that has really no meaning, maybe for the artist, but certainly not for the viewer. Can have all sorts of meanings, or it can be rather traditional.
Right. Yeah, and the materials used, it was fascinating to read your book and see, well, not only the beautiful photographs of these pieces, but to learn what they were made of. And I guess in this country, they've taken a variety of forms, haven't they?
Yes, they have. I mean, the first sculptures, and we can put that in parentheses,
yeah,
were created by the group of Dukha indigenous peoples who came from Siberia 30,000 years BCE, which is incredible. This is before the pyramids, before Roman Greek sculpture. And, of course, they were creating their work in mammal shards, in miniature, because there were miniature horses at that time, miniature of horse shards, and then we go through the First Nations, the Inuit carvers, who, of course, they used bone as well, but First Nations, it was largely wood. And right up to today, where, as I indicated earlier, it can be absolutely anything.
Right. And you do take that view through history and thousands of years. Does a unique style emerge, Maria? Is there something uniquely Canadian?
No, I wish there were, in a way. Remember, we have been influenced by artist styles outside of the country, really, from very, very early on. If you look, for example, at argillite carvings by Haida peoples, they were incorporating Queen Victoria, before Queen Victoria, the American Eagle, and we're talking about the mid-19th century, or even early 19th century. So there is no real style. One would like to think, we might say there are changing styles, but this is what made the book for me so interesting, the research, is that it has, I won't say evolved, because that's rather unfair, because today we have sculpture in all forms, from realism to postmodern to modernist. But as you will see by flipping through the book, did you think there was one style?
No, because, you know, I was thinking, I was looking at some of the statues, especially the ones in public squares. They look like the statues that you'd see in America or you'd see in Europe, say.
Yeah.
And so you don't think of automatically it's a Canadian, I mean, other than the person having some significance to the country's history.
That's absolutely right. No, that's absolutely right. So it's very, very difficult. And, I mean, there's a very good book that's parallel to mine on Australian sculpture, and they more or less come up with the same idea. Having said that, we have, throughout the history of Canadian sculpture, we've got Canadian themes, if you like.
Right.
This incredible 18th century, 17th century nun, Marie Lemaire de Hong, her work incorporated the flora and fauna of Quebec at that time, of New France. And in one of her pieces, the Virgin Mother wears native moccasins. So, you know, this we have used what is indigenous to us.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the First Nations
right.
have for most of their career, although throughout history we can see that even artists like Don Yeomans now, if you've seen his totem pole at the Vancouver airport, it incorporates Chinese characters, the Celtic knots from Ireland,
mm-hmm.
as well as First Nation images. So what do you say to that? Maybe that's the best example of, you know, sort of multicultural carving.
It's exciting to read your book because then you see that sculpture is as diverse as the country.
Absolutely. And, I mean, for instance, let's just take the example of the First World War. During the First World War, there were artists who were commissioned, and, of course, they were mostly from Toronto and Montreal,
mm-hmm.
and they were all white, Anglo-Saxon, you know,
right.
Canadians, as we thought of them.
Yeah.
And yet, the very, very large Japanese contingent produced their own sculpture because they, you know, 4,000 Japanese contributed to the First World War, and they were among the Canadian ranks. There was a small contingent that was separate. And in 1919, they set up their own memorial in Stanley Park.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
It's diverse on that level.
How is Canadian sculpture viewed compared to other forms of art? Because I mean, you wrote what a lot of people consider the book on Emily Carr. Paintings and drawings seem to take up a lot of people's attention.
No, that's a very, very good point. In fact, one American artist said that we only notice sculpture when we back up in a gallery and bang into it in order to look at a painting. So, yeah, I mean, that's a fabulous question. With sculpture, as you will have seen, looking at these massive pieces, look, it's expensive to produce.
Mm.
It's very difficult to move once you've done it.
Yeah.
If you're going to exhibit in a gallery, that costs a lot of money. If you are a woman, it takes great strength. However, I was pleased to point out that there were many female artists, sculptures in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things factor into the reason why, you know, when we, you know, as you said initially, when you think of sculpture, you think of war memorials or things that we see in public squares that don't really seem Canadian. They have more affinity with British or, say, American sculptures.
Yeah.
The other thing, talking about public space for just a sec, what's fascinating when I read your book is the reaction from the public, whether it was, you know, several decades ago when a particular sculpture was erected, or today, that they reflect not only the artist's work, obviously, but where society is.
I think about more where society is than the work itself. And, for example, and changing attitudes to
specific
work. Ed Zelnick produced in the 1960s an enormous piece that for Ottawa, for Confederation Park in Ottawa, that resembled a worm. So it was called Traffic, but everybody called it the worm, and there was a great outcry to get rid of this thing, you know, in our capital city. But after a few years, people living in Ottawa or visiting Ottawa would take people to see it.
Mm.
And it became a kind of icon. Then, when in the 1980s, the National Gallery, with their new building, they moved it, and today it's in storage. So one piece can have many, many meanings, and they're treated in various ways. And you're absolutely right. They do reflect the mentality of the public at that moment. And I'm glad to say, with The Worm, with Ed Zelnick's piece, they show that people can be flexible. People aren't, the public at large, aren't just conservative, but they can change. That,
right.
that some of these works of art can become endearing to people.
What's also amusing is how people argue about who's paying for it and what art is, and that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think one reaction to this is that in the last, 20 years or so, there have been a lot of sculpture symposiums. There have been sculpture parks, like the Jeffrey Rubinoff Sculpture Park on Hornby Island, which have emerged, where sculptors are kind of taking control of their own work, showing it in their own space.
Yeah.
And, you know, the public can come and look at it. Kathy Olhe has done this also in Calgary. But there's a sculpture park in New Brunswick, one in Nova Scotia. So this is what is happening. This is a way to bypass the city council who commission your work, and they decide they don't like it, like the sculpture produced of Louis Riel in 1968 by John Nugent, and the premier at the time, Roth, hated it and told him to produce something new, and he produced another one, and Roth didn't like that, and then he produced another one, and finally they liked it, but it ended up in storage eventually.
This talks about something that's I'm talking from Vancouver, the Terry Fox Memorial.
Absolutely.
Franklin Allen had created this thing, I guess, what was that, in the 80s?
Yes, that was created in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And once again, the public did not like it because it was a kind of Roman arch with four plastic lions on top. I mean, it's a postmodernist piece, and Erickson was on the jury of it and liked it very much. But it was eventually taken down, and what the public got in the end was four sculptures of various sizes of Terry Fox doing his hop, skip, gait marathon across Canada. And they're very happy with it.
Yeah. You mentioned Rubinoff a moment ago, and he's in recent years, I guess he died. But he's a fascinating figure because he had all this these sculptures of his, and some of them had been bought off by other people, but
not
he bought
many.
Them back.
Not many.
Few. No. And yet, right up to the end, created these pieces, and then had them and have them still today. You can go there to Hornby, I guess, and look at them. Again, that's big. I mean, he had his own personal resources, I guess, that he was able to do that.
Yes.
But it's accessible, isn't it?
That's a very good point. You have to remember that Rubinoff had made his reputation. He was at the leading gallery in New York. He had a big show at a big sculpture park in outside of Chicago. So he made his reputation before doing it. But what Rubinoff was doing, partly just a rejection of the art system, the sort of things we've been talking about, the control of the curators, the control of people commissioning it. And Rubinoff wanted to have sole control over what he was producing and how it was exhibited. And, of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, this takes great resources. And most artists who create sculpture parks like Kathy Olhe outside of Calgary, they end up having the local council or the Alberta government taking charge of it because, I mean, it's expensive to keep up.
Yeah.
So it comes down to a matter of financing. And from the very beginning, certainly in the 19th century, as I said, it's expensive stuff to produce. And, artists with their easels of course, artists now, painters are going beyond the easel, but they really have an easier time of it. There's no doubt. And also, because sculpture itself appears in public places, in a square, in front of an office building, inside an office building, so that you actually see it. I mean, let's face it, if we go to an art gallery, we go there with a purpose.
Yeah.
We walk through the door, we pay our money, and we're going to look at a specific piece or an exhibition. But the sculpture, you know, we're bumping into it.
Yeah.
And for some people, it might become an eyesore.
Yeah. Well, the evolution of sculpture, I mean, I hate to use that term, but especially with technology nowadays, 3D printing and
yes.
virtual reality, I mean, are you looking forward to innovations in sculpture with regards to technology and how that's
well,
evolved?
Well, I think that I certainly don't want just conservative traditional bronze statues, so there seems to be a place for it. Canadians like it. I think some of the 3D conceptual works that are being done, like the work by Evan Penny, where he takes a lot of photographs of different people and then somehow, through the computer, makes a compilation. So his figures are called No Name because they have no name. They're a compilation. And then what he does is he puts them through a 3D computer and produces a plastic mold. It's actually twice the size of the human head or human figure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the end product. Now, I find that fascinating. Some people may find it gimmicky, but I find it fascinating. And, you know, sculpture can't remain stagnant, just like First Nations art hasn't remained stagnant. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of people want Inuit art to be the same and, you know, depictions of seals and hunters and Inuk men and women. But even the Inuit themselves are incorporating other ideas, which are not very popular from the people who collect what they think is authentic Inuit art.
Yeah. It's funny how audiences have their own conception of what art is, and it often runs contrary to, the vision of the artist.
Oh, yes. And sometimes with contemporary sculpture, it is even more difficult because the sculptor, him or herself, they're not producing a realistic image, or they're producing something that they produced in their mind, they've envisioned in their mind, but doesn't necessarily translate to reality or to the end product. Or they produce something that they want the audience to complete. So it gets very, very wishy-washy. And I find this all exciting, and certainly exciting for sculptors who are producing these different kinds of sculptures. I mean, of course, now the word sculpture can, you know, it's can mean so many different things.
Now, Maria, you're someone who has taught art, has written extensively on it, and this is your career. How does, this is fascinating to me about you, I've talked to you twice now, how has your own taste, say, changed over the years? I mean, are you less critical, say, about what you like and what you don't like?
Well, I think what I've learned to do is certainly as a scholar, try not to have dislikes and likes. Now, you know, you may say, oh, that's impossible because, you know, your gut reacts
right.
to that work. But really, when I was choosing work for this book and when I was writing about it, you know, I just said to myself, I've got to be as open as possible. And, you know, I may not be in love with this or that work, but it is, I think I get around it for myself, my own sort of intellectual development, by looking at the circumstances under which it is produced. And I think being a cultural historian rather than an art historian, the art historians generally don't look beyond the canvas or don't think of what's inside the painting, what's inside the frame of the painting. And a cultural historian tries to look at the work of art but put it in the context of society and or the circumstances in which the artist, writer, you know, architect is working. And I think that enables me to appreciate and to understand where the work is coming from, whether I happen to like it or not. I mean, if you, you know, came into my house on Tender Island, where I'm standing now, you'd see all kinds of sculpture from very traditional to modernist to postmodernist. So you may say, oh, yeah, you know, you're interested in, you know, all kinds of sculpture or all kinds of paintings.
Uh-huh.
But I think when you're a scholar, you've got to be really, really careful. And, of course, I hedge it by being a cultural historian and putting things in context. And that makes me be able to convince myself that I understand these works. That's what I'm after. I'm trying to understand why and how this stuff was created. And, you know, that's why I write books, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you travel... are you able to say doff the scholar hat and say when you go to a gallery, you encounter a gallery, go in and go in there for your own leisure, say?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and sometimes I enjoy it and sometimes I don't. I was just at an exhibition of contemporaries of Virginia Woolf in St. Ives in England about 3 weeks ago. And I thought it was a terrible exhibition. You know, and so I probably, and a lot of the labels of the works on display, they had the wrong dates of artists' lives, birth and death, and that sort of thing. And I have to say, I did have a word with the curator, you know, so,
yeah,
you know, that, if it's close to my patch, I can be pretty critical. Mm. And I used to review quite a bit for Canadian Art, and I don't do that anymore. I still review, you know, books and art books.
Uh-huh.
Actual exhibitions, I don't do as much.
Well, this is a marvelous book, and it's a beautiful book as well, and I so enjoyed reading it, and as well as looking at the photographs. Congratulations on it. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you again, Maria.
Well, thanks so much.
The book is called Sculpture in Canada, A History. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Dr. Maria Tippett, joined me on the line from Pender Island in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.